This work that I've done with Fang Chen, his graduate student, Andrew Frey, you might know him, he's a postdoc, and Fredette and Rabideau are undergrads at McGill. It's really nice work for me this summer and fall. And these are other graduate students as well. I'm going to divide this into roughly two sections. I'll give you an introduction where I quickly review the experimental motivation for why many things that we see hopefully could be explained by annihilating dark matter. And then I'll review this theoretical framework that Arkani Hamed et al. Proposed to try and explain everything. I'll tell you how it's supposed to do that and some of the new constraints which are making it difficult to do. So experimentally, we see a number of anomalies. There's Pramela going up to 100 JeV. There was Attic and PPB bets staying in excess. So the Pramela was positron excess. These are, they don't distinguish electrons from positrons. So it's a lepton excess up to around TeV. Fermi has seen a smaller excess, but it's a similar region. One I will focus a lot on today is this very long-standing excess of low-energy positrons from the center of the galaxy, seen by the integral experiment. There's this Finkmeyer and Flaner friends have this WMAP haze, these unaccounted for microwave photons, and now they're arguing also in the Fermi data. And finally, it's also been suggested that the Dama results could be understood in this framework I'll discuss.
One of these is different than the other, right?
Well, I give less emphasis to this one myself. That's what you had in mind.
So what do you mean one is different than the others? I mean, all are different. You mean a different model you need to explain it?
Well, in the sense that there was skepticism that the signal, you know, that the effect was, they understood their errors.
But all of them are skepticism for all of them. So.
That's very true.
But the magnitude of skepticism, I think, is not the same.
It depends on the US.
Then you're talking sociology. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, but Attic is not terribly consistent with Fermi, right? I mean,
well, I'll show you in just a moment. Yeah, that's true.
They look for it.
So, well, you've all seen the Pamela data, and compared to the diffusive model expectations, there's this large excess of positrons, but not of other antiparticles, not antiprotons in particular. And then here's
so do you understand why that's the worst theoretical fit in the history? You know, those are 2 points. I mean, why do they never show you the curve which is supposed to fit these lower dots?
Well, what I've heard is that this is...
But there's a theory for that. Why can't somebody draw a graph?
I suppose somebody could, but I guess they just feel like it's not so important because... So you probably can fit it there by including the solar modulation effects, but you know that they cut off around here, and so this is the part that should be interesting. That's what I've heard.
I mean, Pierre's talk, he was showing how you can lower the... You should look at Pierre's talk online.
He actually shows the...
Well, he can do both.
Yeah.
Which is not good. But just by modifying the propagation model. You manipulate that.
That's what I'm like.
You can't fit the rising spectrum.
You could fit it not to the degree it seems to rise, but you could get it to rise.
He would say, though, that it needed a new source.
It does rise.
So just a lot of you.
Okay. Sorry.
Okay.
So even the other one is not balanced. Even background of this one is not balanced. And you were saying Dama's background is not balanced. This is what I'm saying. I'm arguing that our background is not balanced, really, so, because you don't get that solar.
Yeah. Well, I think this background just doesn't put in that solar modulation.
Yeah.
Then so looking at the higher energy part, here's the Attic, and that was PPB. That's slightly bigger error bars. So those have this bump-like feature. You see some excess from the Hess data as well, which is consistent. The newer Fermi data is It's a bit inconsistent with that, but still compared to the most basic diffusive model expectations, there's some hint of an excess.
The other thing you get from that picture is that everybody's underestimating their systematic errors, right?
Yeah.
We had a talk where people were complaining about putting these data sets together. The systematics are different. So this might be the theorist's fault.
And the one I said I was going to focus a lot on, this is only the most recent observation. It's been seen for 40 years by a variety of experiments that there's excess of 511 keV radiation from the galactic center, and its morphology is pretty spherically symmetric with half maximum around 8 degrees. So there's the profile in on the sky, and here it is. Energy spectrum showing you it's a pretty narrow line. So these presumably positrons are at rest basically when they're annihilating. And in fact, it's even known that a large fraction of them, from looking at the details, annihilation spectrum are in positronium, so they're captured. Something like 80% of them are in positronium, or 90%.
And the distribution of the galaxy in the picture looks like it is not centered in the center.
Yeah, that's the center.
But it looks like it's a little bit to the right of it. It looks like it's kind of zero.
I mean, if you look at this picture, it's pretty symmetric. I don't think.
I see there's a log scale or something. I don't know.
That's the center.
Yeah, okay. I see it. These don't look like perfect circles, right?
But even your plot on the bottom, that looks like it's peaking around 5 or 4.
That's latitude, though. That's not
latitude.
The top one is longitude.
This is longitude.
So longitude means that would be other than this. Is that
the longitude is horizontal, latitude is vertical.
If you just look at this picture, it's pretty symmetric.
But you don't have the other half of that.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's just not showing the other half because that's like showing negative radius, right?
But it's not the negative radius. You have an image in the sky, so you have both left dotted line and the right.
Yeah, I don't know why they show it that way. But there are other pictures where you see the whole blob, and it's fairly spherical symmetric. The Sobiemap haze has been interpreted as synchrotron radiation from the emitted leptons. And it's just showing you the excess that Finkbeiner and company extract from Wmap data. And, I guess dots are their excess, and the line is their fit to dark matter.
Is there any independent? I mean, I know Finkbeiner and Hooper have been pushing this. Is there any other group that has actually been able to redo this analysis as yet?
I'm not aware of it, and I am aware of other people who say that they don't agree with it. We should already, collaborators don't agree with it. I haven't been following this very much. So. If there are other people who corroborate it, I'm not sure.
Is there anyone who corroborates this at all?
Well, I think it's... I don't think there's much quantitative work on it. It's just that others claim that you don't understand galactic foregrounds well enough to distinguish these things from each other. So because you have to basically separate different galactic foregrounds to dig this one out.
Yeah.
And there's synchrotron, there's free emission, there is dust emission. And the question is, do you understand all of them? So that's the real question. And I think the thing that Doug Finkbeiner is the expert expert. At least was before
he became two experts.
That's the thing. So he was the expert on the dust emission and all the galactic foregrounds before he became a dark matter person. And then other people, I don't know, they're not quite as sure. I don't think anybody has proven that this is wrong, it's just they're not quite as sure as.
Yeah. I think it's one of those things where if it was by itself, you wouldn't think very much of it. Taken in connection with everything else, you give it more credence, perhaps. And so, there have been many proposals for astrophysical sources to explain these things, and it seems that the most likely explanation is pulsars. People on the Fermi collaboration themselves have looked at this possibility, and this is showing you the range of predictions you can get from pulsars, which are known to be sources of positrons, by varying the unknown pulsar parameters within reasonable uncertainties. So it's showing that you can get pretty much what you want from the pulsars, but you can't make a sharp prediction. This is true for the Manila region as well as the Fermi region.
And is each of those curves for one pulsar, or is that kind of averaging over all pulsars?
I meant to look that up, and I'm not sure. I think it could be just a few pulsars contributing primarily, but to reread that paper.
So the uncertainty here is the number of pulsars, or?
I thought it was properties of the pulsars themselves.
Yeah. It's both.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. No one knows how a pulsar really works. It's like a bunch of fudge factors that put it and makes very 1% you can do all this.
And so it's not only they don't know how the pulsar work, but they also don't know how many.
They know the ones they know about, but they don't know the ones they don't know about.
They say they can even fit it with the ones they know about.
Yeah.
If they
Gamingas, a couple others.
And so what you gather from this is that even though pulsars may be the right explanation, looks like it'll be hard to prove that they are the right one. And so maybe the better, or maybe it's still a worthwhile thing to do, you can try to rule out the dark matter explanation. See if it gives us something, some other testable consequences that we can verify it with. So here's the framework that Arkani Hamed and company proposed to explain everything. It's simply dark matter which transforms under non-abelian gauge symmetry. It's dark, some dark force mediated by gauge bosons. And of course, you have to have some communication of the standard model. And you know, two main ways that have been proposed are kinetic mixing with the weak hypercharge of, say, one component. And so which component mixes can be singled out by, say, a triplet, the bev of a triplet Higgs field in the dark sector. Or you could have, through the Higgs portal, some dark Higgs mixing with the standard model Higgs. And, both are interesting possibilities. I will largely focus on the first one in this talk. And here's an example of how you can explain Fermi and Camilla. Take the simplest case, SU2, and consider dark matter in the triplet representation, for example. And suppose it's the second color of gauge boson that mixes with the hypercharge, and there's some, so when you divide the triplet bev by this unknown scale, it's some small parameter epsilon for the kinetic mixing strength. Notice that in the non-abelian theory, all these gauge couplings are off-diagonal, and that plays an important role here. So what happens is two dark matter in the galaxy, they annihilate by exchange of another color, and that means you have to emit two dark gauge bosons, and then because of the kinetic mixing, those can decay into E plus E minus. Now, why just E plus E minus and not antiprotons? That would, if you produce antiprotons, that would disagree with Camilla. Well, if you just assume that the mass of the dark gauge boson is smaller than the proton mass, then these can't decay into pp bar, and so you just get the lightest things that couple to hypercharge. And you can see why it's important to have a non-abelian gauge group, because if I try to do this with an abelian one, then I would have this diagonal coupling to the gauge field, and I would go through a single off-shell gauge boson and decay into all possible quarks. Wouldn't matter what the mass is here because it's off-shell. So I would get top quarks and everything and antiprotons.
Why can't I always diagonalize B2?
diagonalize what?
Why can't I just diagonalize, since you're only, there's only one generator you're following that's broken, why can't I just go to a basis for that diagonal?
Well, because then I could just exchange the chi 2 here instead of the chi 3. Oh, no, I'm sorry. What's diagonal? All the generators are off diagonal in this. There aren't any diagonal cut points. These are Majorana fields.
Oh.
And, Yeah, actually, I should have said that as well.
So the dark matter particles are Majorana in this case?
Well, in this case, you can also do it with, I could do it with doublet dark matter. It still works. It still works out with doublet dark matter, in fact. So, now, one of the important ingredients to make all of this work is the annihilation cross-section you need to explain Mellon and Fermi is too big to get the right relic density. And so you need to have a way of enhancing the cross-section at low velocities in the galaxy relative to in the early universe. And the Sommerfeld enhancement does that for you. It's just the effect when two particles move past each other slowly enough, they have more time to interact. So that increases the cross-section. That's true classically, and you see it quantum mechanically as a result of the exchange of many gauge bosons. And it's something that you can easily compute for this S-wave annihilation diagram. You can just compute it in quantum mechanics, treating these as non-relativistic particles. And so you find this enhancement factor, or boost factor, there I plotted the log of it as a function of some parameters, the gauge boson mass, the gauge coupling, and the mass of dark matter. So you get these resonances depending on whether you got lucky and have the right combination of these microphysics parameters. And apart from the resonances, you also get the effect that at higher velocity, this goes down to unit boost factor. And at lower velocity, these resonances get sharper and sharper. And, you can easily get boost factors of 1,000 or more for dark matter in the galaxy.
So I don't understand. Higher velocity is not unit,
it would keep going down. I didn't mean, yeah, here it's relative. I still took a low velocity, it's just higher than this one. So it would go down to zero boosts.
So what determines whether you have these resonances or not?
That's just whether you happen to have this combination of parameters coming out to be certain values. And I don't know if there's a
That'd be nice. Resonances in the exchange.
Sorry?
Isn't it resonances in the exchange? Something's got to go on a shell.
Yeah, I'm sure there's a nice intuitive explanation for those things. But not sure now. Think about that. So that was explaining Fermi and Pamela. Now, you need a different process for 511 keV excess, and Finkbeiner and Wiener have proposed this excited dark matter mechanism to do it, where instead of annihilating, the dark matter can... And so it's important here that in the process of breaking the gauge symmetry, we want this new dark gauge symmetry to be broken. And you naturally, I'll show you the next slide, I guess. You naturally get splittings between the members of the dark matter multiplet. And these splittings can naturally be small. So if you have splittings of order in MeV, then there's just barely enough kinetic energy of dark matter in the galaxy to be able to excite from chi 1 up to chi 3. And then this chi 3, because of its coupling to the gauge boson that's talks to the standard model, it can decay back down to the round state and E plus E minus. And because this mass splitting is only MeV, E plus E minus are already non-relativistic. And so you don't have to worry about slowing down the positron before it annihilates. And a similar mechanism is used to explain this Dhamma Libra annual modulation, except now you just imagine scattering a chi 1 on a nucleon, and then you would take advantage of this lower mass splitting, order 100 keV. So then you would have to excite, because of the off-diagonal nature of the gauge bubbles, you have to excite to a chi 2 state in order to have any interaction. And that's the explanation proposed for why Dhamma would be able to see these things.
But what is the mass itself?
Oh, the dark matter?
Yeah.
Well, for Fermi and Pamela, we're assuming it's of order TeV, but if you just wanted to explain this, then you'd have a lot more freedom in choosing that.
But you want the velocity of dark matter particles to correspond to that 100 keV or something like that.
You want m, the kinetic energy of the dark matter to correspond to that. That's right. And then just because Dhamma is made from iodine, sodium iodide, and other detectors are made from other materials, they have different sensitivities to processes requiring this energy threshold. So one can try to explain why Dhamma sees something, but other detectors don't. And here's the origin of the small mass splittings. It just comes from radiative corrections. And so in this model I showed you of triplet dark matter, you can compute these loop diagrams, and you find that if the spontaneous symmetry breaking didn't give all the same masses to the gauge bosons, then that's going to show up in these loop diagrams as mass splittings between the dark matter states, and it's suppressed by the gauge coupling. So that can take... If these gauge bosons were of order MeV mass, then I can use the alpha to get the splittings down to... if these were GeV mass, I can use the gauge coupling to get the splittings down to MeV scale.
Why don't those things go like... Why isn't the WM going like M5? Because why isn't there a chiral symmetry that protects the mass of the...
There is... but now we're looking at the limit where m is much bigger than mu, so you don't see it. But if I wrote these formulas in all their generality and you took the opposite limit of m being much smaller than mu, then you would see it.
So you're just looking at the differences here, not in the world.
Yeah, and I'm throwing away an overall shift in the masses as well. So people have done fits of these sorts of models to the data. Need at all find this allowed region for Pamela. This is for Fermi, and the green is for Pamela. You see there's some overlap, and I guess so you would want 3 × 10⁻²⁶ cross section down here for the freeze out, and so you need a boost factor from Sommerfeld enhancement of order 300 to get that big cross section. And then just from looking at where the Fermi, so Pamela doesn't tell you where this cuts off, but Fermi showed you that the spectrum's cutting off around the TeV, so that fixes the dark matter mass roughly.
So can I ask a question? Yeah. So when people think this, right, and you say you need a boost factor of 300 or so, and the plot you showed before is that the resonances can be very narrow.
Mm-hmm.
So the dark matter velocity will also change depending where you are. I mean, if you're more towards the galactic center, you might not hit the resonance, and if you're all the other way around, so does this thing.
I don't think they took that into account, and that's something that, with the, I'm going to get to it, it's something we're trying to take into account more carefully. I think these authors just assumed a constant loose factor. That should be done better. Now, the constraints are starting to squeeze on that parameter space rather strongly because these same kind of processes were going on in the early universe, and the production of leptons in the early universe changes the details of recombination, and CMB is sensitive to that, the ionization fraction. That's one of the things that gets measured by WMAP. And so that has the effect of ruling out a lot of the region of in the same parameter space we're just looking at of cross-section versus the mass. So this part's ruled out by W map, this part will be ruled out by Planck. And if you just superimpose those, you see that this ruled out region is pretty well covering what I wanted for Fanella and Fermi. On the other hand, other authors, Cholas and company, they get a different fit for Fanella and Fermi, which is a little bit farther down. You can kind of see it here. They claim that this region 4 is what fits that same model. So their analysis of the background is different from native at all. Yeah.
So are you, is there a possibility of a boost just in the density? Just in, are you, when you say there's a boost, you're boosting just cross sections?
Yeah, in this model, I'm just boosting the cross section. And yeah, if you have additional boosts from changes to the density profile, then that would be on top of this. So they're making.
You know where your cross section is.
This is early universe.
This slide's really interesting.
There can't be any boost.
But the previous slides there.
Yeah. So that one, in fact, people have shown that there is some boost also. You can have some boost also in the early universe, and that puts further constraints on these models. But generally, I mean, the general idea was you don't get boosts in the early universe. Now, lately, people have started to question that assumption and find out, oh, we do get some boosts, and now we have to redo what we thought we needed for the galaxy.
And I'm sorry to come late, but the earlier slides were using the...
I was just basically reviewing the Fanella for me.
Right.
And
so the one you just showed for this assumes that it's a W profile.
Actually, this one assumed... Using an isothermal profile. Yeah, and they have different predictions for different profiles. I showed the isothermal profile here for... in fact, the reason I showed it here is because now you also have these constraints coming from the Hess data, inverse Compton scattering of the leptons emitted here off the photons in the galaxy. And Hess looks for those things, and so that rules out region of primary space, which for the models which are actually thought to better fit than isothermal, they actually squeeze this parameter space as well. And
to go back to isothermal, you don't like the model.
Well, and also I had reasons for thinking that this could actually be a better representation of the real dark matter profile. So that was another reason I showed this one. But yeah, it's good to be aware that those assumptions.
What reasons are there? Are those?
Well, one reason was I'm going to talk about the effects of production of leptons coming from substructure, which is outside of the galactic center. And if you manage to move the production of the leptons away from the galactic center, that's going to weaken these Hess constraints, which are coming from observations of the galactic center. But another reason is I just found out about a paper which takes into account the effects of baryons on the concentration of dark matter at the galactic center. And they're now advocating an isothermal growth, one over r squared growth from the baryons. So that still could be the best fit after all. Yeah, okay, so that's all I wanted to say about what's generally known and what's been proposed, and I'll spend the rest of this talk talking about what we did on this. And basically, well, one thing that we did was to look at explicit models and to see what their detailed implications were, not only for these data, but also on the early universe nucleus synthesis. So, see if they had anything to say vis-a-vis laboratory constraints. And for a lot of this talk, I'm going to be discussing this excited dark matter mechanism because we just finished our most recent paper was, I think, the most quantitative treatment to date on that mechanism. Finally, I'll just say a few words about what I mentioned. Subhalos could be contributing significantly to those lepton excesses. So these are the papers. These first two were the model building papers. This one was with the undergraduates on excited dark matter and the subhalo stuff is work in progress with Vincent and Xu. Well, if you're going to build such a model, then you have to make choices. You have to choose which dark gauge group you'll consider. We looked at SU2 for simplicity. Other authors looked at other gauge groups. And then you have to choose which representations for the dark matter. So we looked at some of the simplest low-lying representations. You have to choose how you're going to break the dark gauge symmetry, because you want to give masses to the gauge bosons and mass splittings to the dark matter. So we looked at various combinations of dark Higgses and choosing their bets. You also have to choose which portal to the standard model you're going to look at, and we also considered both, but because I don't have much time, I'm going to focus on the gauge kinetic mixing one. So then you can do things like compute the relic density and all the spectral gauge bosons and the dark matter splittings. But when we did this, we kind of stumbled upon something that we weren't expecting. And this is this coupling of dark matter to photons. That's the hypercharge, but it contains a photon. And this is a one-loop coupling as transition magnetic moment, which exists because of the non-abelian nature of the theory. You know, in the gauge kinetic term for the dark gauge bosons, because it's non-abelian, there's a cubic term in there. And the mixing of B1 to the hypercharge means that we get a cubic coupling of photon to B2 and B3. And now this we can connect to some of the dark matter states, and this turns out to be a magnetic moment coupling, as it would have to be, since these are uncharged. And so you can just compute that diagram and estimate it, and you realize that if you're able to make these excited states like we want to do for explaining the integral data, that means that not only can the excited state decay back down to the ground state plus leptons, but it can decay to this middle state and a photon, as I've shown here. So that's another signal that ought to show up in the integral data if it was there. And we computed the branching ratio for this, and using the fact that integral hasn't yet reported any such thing, we were able to compute a constraint on the gauge coupling, which depends on assumptions about the masses and mass splittings of the other states.
So I don't understand. What is it that integral hasn't reported?
Well, this would be a monoenergetic photon, and its energy would be equal to the mass splitting of chi3 and chi2. So this would be a line in your spectrum. It would be close to the 511 keV line.
Why should it be close to the 511 keV?
Because in this picture of the... go back to this scenario. So we wanted chi3 to chi1 is the transition that gives us E plus E minus. And we want that to be of order MeV, so we get non-relativistic E plus E minus. And now the transition I'm talking about is chi3 to chi2. So that's also of order MeV in this picture.
So the other decay is tree level, chi3 to through a B2
yeah.
or something?
Yeah, exactly. Okay. That's a tree diagram. Well, this number is kind of interesting now if you do the rest of the exercise I mentioned of computing the relic density. So we computed these tedious diagrams, and we worked it out pretty exactly what the annihilation cross-section is and as a function of the representation of the dark matter. And from that, we got what you need for the gauge coupling in order to get the right relic density, also depending on the mass of the dark matter. And we're assuming a TeV to fit Fermi. So if you look at our bound around 0.08, you see that that's not so far off. In fact, it's just 0.08. It's almost the same as if we had the doublet dark matter. So it means that it's not unreasonable to think that such a thing could be occurring. And maybe this is something that the integral people look for. Another thing that we noticed as we were doing all this is a constraint that hadn't been discussed in the literature before, and it's related to an idea of these gentlemen, They had suggested that the gauge boson that couples to the standard model could be long-lived enough that it could travel out of the center of the galaxy before it decayed into E plus E minus. And their reasoning was, again, to weaken the gamma ray constraints from HESS, which looks for the center of the galaxy, or the main contribution from there. But if V1 was long-lived enough for that to happen, then it would also be present during Big Bang nucleosynthesis, and it would be dominating. And so that's ruled out, and you can compute, if you want these things to decay before Big Bang nucleosynthesis, then that gauge kinetic mixing parameter has to be bigger than 10 to the minus 11 versus a smaller value you would need to get such long-lived intermediate states.
So what's the order of the lifetime of this?
Well, this would be around a second, I guess, if you wanted to decay just before nucleosynthesis. And in this case, it's going to be 10 to the 10 times longer.
So these are non-relativistic here in BBN?
Yeah, because these are GdB
bosons.
So they dominate there.
They would dominate, yeah. And just for comparison, these are the constraints that currently exist in the plane of epsilon and the mass of the gauge boson coming from various fixed target experiments from anomalous like muon magnetic moments from epsilon decay from emission of these guys by supernovae. Our bound is somewhere down here. So you see there's still lots of parameter space here to play with, and experimenters are proposing, their experiments proposed now to fill in some of these gaps that were discussed at recent conference at SLAC. So it's nice to see that there's some interplay between the cosmology and the laboratory here. Now I want to come to the thing that we finished most recently. This is looking more in detail at, I think, Binder-Winer excited dark matter mechanism. So here was that picture I showed you for exciting the top state. And so again, we have this problem that this cross-section has to be a lot bigger than what you need for getting the right Rayleigh density from just a single exchange. And so you hope that by exchange of multiple gauge boson through these ladder diagrams that you'll be able to enhance it enough. Now, Pospelov and Ritz, shortly after this proposal, claimed that just using unitarity, you can't get it to be big enough. And here's the expression of the cross-section expanded in partial waves. So if I let these partial wave amplitudes go to 1, that would be the unitarity bound. And so their observation is that if only a few partial waves are contributing, then even saturating unitarity, you can't get a big enough cross-section to get the observed signal. Of course, that doesn't address the question of, well, how many L's might be contributing, because if you have enough of them, then you can get a big enough cross-section. So that was the question we wanted to answer. And if you try to address it by computing these ladder diagrams in quantum field theory, you're sunk, because that's a nightmare. But it was pointed out in the same paper of Arkani-Hamid et al. That you don't have to do that. You can just solve the Schrodinger equation. This was the paper that proposed the whole non-abelian dark matter scenario. Because the dark matter is highly non-relativistic. And so all we really have to do is solve this two-component Schrodinger equation for the ground state and the excited state in this Yukawa potential, which has off-diagonal components because the dark matter has to change color in each interaction. And so here's what the potential looks like, where this, I scale things so that this 1 is just representing the mass difference between the ground states and the two excited states. And we've done some rescalings to make everything dimensionless here. So there are a few dimensionless parameters I'm going to refer to. This gamma is multiplying the whole potential, so it goes like the strength of the gauge coupling, but it also depends on the mass over the mass splitting of the dark matter. This delta is just telling you the kinematics. It's the velocity of the incoming particles over the threshold velocity to produce the excited states squared. And then this dimensionless eta appearing in the power potential, it's the range of the potential in these variables. It's dark matter, inverse range, dark matter mass, but it's scaled by the H coupling and the mass splitting. So what you have to do is just solve the Schrodinger equation subject to the boundary condition of only incoming states of the ground state and no incoming excited states. And in principle, that's something that we can do numerically. We don't know how to do it analytically. But even numerically, it turned out to be rather challenging. And part of the challenge is that in some cases, you can have hundreds of partial waves contributing significantly. And here I'm showing you the sum of all these partial waves. This is basically sigma times the relative velocity, which is entering into the rate. And you see, for this choice of parameters, we finally get convergence of these partial sums when we get to 200 partial waves. And well, this is for relatively low gauge boson mass. If I increase the gauge boson mass, that's going to lower the range of the potential and we'll need fewer partial waves, like in this picture.
Can you step back?
Yeah. To this.
So if the one were zero, this would be a much easier problem to solve.
Oh, yeah. So it was just elastic scattering.
What's your perturbation theory about that?
Trying to think. So it's important. It's really important to be on to be above threshold. And
what is threshold?
The energy to or the velocity to produce the excited state particles.
And we'll be very close to threshold.
Oh yeah. Well, we will end up being very close to the threshold, but the fact that the threshold exists is crucial to the whole problem. If we didn't have the threshold, then we wouldn't get the suppression that's going to make life difficult for us. So maybe what you're suggesting is worth trying.
I mean, it's sufficiently high energy.
But we can't go to high energy. We're stuck at low energy within the galaxy.
No, but just as a mathematical problem.
Yeah.
Once you get a little away from threshold, then the mass difference is not going to be as important effect as the mixing. If it were zero, you could just diagonalize them.
Right.
And then it would be a one-dimensional problem. And then you could really easily solve that on
a
computer. And then the question is how many flips. See, then it's a perturbation theory of flips.
Yeah.
And I'm sure that's much more tractable.
Yeah, I think it's more tractable. I'm just not confident that it's going to reproduce the regime accurately that we need. But I agree it's worth trying. And I tried so many things, I can't remember if I tried that one already. And my skepticism was based on knowing that.
Maybe you probably tried it.
I'll have to look at that again. It is something we want to return to. We would have loved to find a semi-analytic. We tried very hard to make WKV approximation work. We couldn't get it to work. So here's a case with smaller gauge boson mass, and you can see you don't need so many partial waves. 100 is overkill, but anyway, we scanned the whole parameter space and we went up to 500 partial waves just to be sure we weren't missing anything. Here's a picture. So speaking of the scan of parameter space, remember this is characterizing the strength of the coupling, and these etas are characterizing the gauge boson mass, and here I'm plotting boost factors as a function of velocity. So people who do Sommerfeld enhancement, they like to phrase things in terms of the boost factor, the actual cross-section compared to the Born approximation. And the funny thing here, so in elastic scattering, that boost factor is always 1 or bigger. But here, we're talking about inelastic processes, and it just turns out that it's not, sometimes the actual cross-section is smaller than the Born. In many of these examples, the so-called boost factor is smaller than 1. Up in this corner is where we're tending to get bigger than 1. And, well, we didn't actually work in terms of boost factor. We just computed the cross-section. But in case people were interested to compare with usual situation, I made this slide. So now, to the meat of the calculation, we have to compute the rate of positron production in the galaxy. So this will be proportional to the density squared and to the average cross-section, and you have to integrate that over the region where you see the positrons being produced, so some radius. And this density profile, we tested various possible forms for it. I'll show you the results of that. And for the average cross-section, you have to average over the velocities of the incoming particles, where this is some kind of Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution with a cutoff at the escape velocity, and it also has a velocity dispersion which varies with radius, as we know from in-body simulations. And we played around with various fits to that dispersion as well. So this is just illustrating the kind of differences you get from the...
Actually, your profile fixes your velocity dispersion. By the Strum-Jones equation.
Yeah, there's a correlation between the two.
So I mean, I think there's that process, and you cannot just play with them independently.
We shouldn't play with them independently, and we try to keep them consistent. But in fact, what I'm going to show you is it's hard to get this thing to work, and so we tried to do everything we could to boost the rate. Even so, it's hard to get it to work. Anyway, this is just showing you people like this iNASCO profile, and here's the older NFW profile, and this is just showing how at moderately small distances the iNASCO profile tends to be more peaked than the NFW. Forget about this black curve, I won't bother with it. That actually flips over at much shorter distances, but these are so close to the center of the galaxy they don't really dominate the rate. Now the velocity dispersion, that was a really important thing for us. Well, so was the other, but this turned out to be really crucial. And it depends a lot on whether you assume that, in the simulations, most people had just assumed that it was pure dark matter and ignored the effect of baryons. And that's good for most of the halo, because the baryons are in such a small portion of the halo. But, of course, we're interested in that central region. And some recent simulations which have put in the effects of baryons have shown that that has a big effect on the velocity dispersion. In the pure dark matter models, the velocity dispersion turns over as you go toward the center of the galaxy. Whereas with the baryons, this reference and now a few other references show that you get a rise and it's diverging mildly with radius. And so this actually helps us to boost the rate because, of course, we want dark matter to be moving fast to have enough speed to produce the excited states.
But the density also goes up, both density and velocity.
Yep, that's right. So here, and so we investigated various possibilities, and here was one of the best combinations we could find. And this is showing you a scan over the microphysics parameter space, this coupling gamma. The gauge boson mass data, and here we're varying the mass splitting between those two states, which you would like to be in MeV, but we're allowing for the possibility that that mass splitting is less than in MeV, and I'll show you why that would make sense. And we've assumed here for Fermi that it's TeV dark matter, and we've assumed this velocity dispersion and a rather strongly peaked profile, density profile. Which is from another simulation that had baryons in it. And so what we find is that the best case scenario, these are contours of the predicted rate over the observed rate, so this is log of that ratio, and so line label 0 is the one that matches the data. And what you notice is that in order to match the data, the delta M has to be smaller than what you want. Here, the highest we're able to get the mass splitting was around 600 kDp, whereas we wanted it to be an MeV or a bit more to have enough phase space to decay in the E plus and minus. And then we tried varying other things like the dark matter mass and this parameter which governs the average velocity. This multiplies the velocity dispersion. And the circular velocity of things at the radius of the solar system, this affects, the bigger the circular velocity is of the solar system, the bigger the escape velocity is. And things are rather sensitive to the escape velocity, because you lose the tail of the distribution when you cut off of the escape velocity. And we tried also varying the distance to the galactic center. So with all of these things, well, dark matter mass variation didn't help much. It boosted it a little bit near 700 keV. This B-naught didn't help much either. We're around 220, so we didn't get much from that. Now, boosting the circular velocity or the escape velocity, that does help. But the canonical number is 220. That's what everybody believes. And so pushing it to 350, I don't think any astronomer would believe that. That's what we would need to get up to the threshold of twice the electron mass. It gets a little less unreasonable if we're willing to vary the distance from the sun to the galactic center. But that's also pushing it. The canonical, the accepted value is 8. We have to push it to 9.5. So I don't think astronomers would believe these values. And so based on this, it looks like we can't get a big enough mass splitting for this decay to happen. And we had noticed this in one of our earlier papers when we did a preliminary analysis. So we suggested to remedy this problem going from this so-called normal hierarchy proposed by Parkhani Hamid and all the friends to what we call the inverted hierarchy. The idea is we have this extra population which is already excited, but it's stable, and we can design a Z2 symmetry to prevent it from decaying into anything. And the idea is that these are already present in the universe, and so you only had to excite them by a much smaller mass splitting in order to get the decay down to a true ground state. So we put that idea out, and promptly Maxime Kosvalov wrote to us and said, hey, those same processes that you want to happen in the galaxy, those can be going on in the early universe too. Excite chi2, chi3, and then it decays, and that would have depleted the chi2 population before the galaxy ever had time to take advantage of it. And so we thought about that, and the reason is that this Sommerfeld enhancement is also occurring at some point in the early universe before now. And so to avoid that, we came up with this idea, which you'll either love it or you'll hate it, and that is of non-thermal dark matter production, which could have come about if there was a precursor dark matter population, say scalars, which were long-lived, and at some point late in the universe they decayed to what we think is the dark matter, or what is the dark matter now. And to make that long-lived decay, you just need to suppress its couplings by some mass scale. So this dimension 6 operator, it's dimension 5 operator, sorry. So this kind of operator, you can imagine this coming from integrating out a gut gauge boson. And then if there was a phase transition where the this new scalar got a BEV, then it would turn into decay-mediating interaction. So how would this help us? Well, the Sommerfeld enhancement goes like 1 over the velocity. Now, at the moment when these S's decay, the chi's are probably going to be relativistic. And so assume that they start out relativistic at the decay temperature, and then they'll start redshifting because of the Hubble expansion. And now you can compute the Sommerfeld enhanced rate of excitations divided by the Hubble rate, and we get this number which gives us a constraint. To keep that out of equilibrium, gives us a constraint on the decay temperature that it has to be below 5 MeV. Now if you go back to our dimension 5 operator and ask what does that require, it means that this combination had to be around the gut scale, which is kind of intriguing.
Isn't this pretty close to BBN?
Yeah, it is rather close to BBN, but I don't think you particularly care whether the dark matter, equation of state changes around the time of BDN. So it's not clear to me that this would matter. Yeah, but I'm saying even if it happened right at BDN, it's not clear to me that the dark matter suddenly becoming fast instead of slow would matter.
I shouldn't think of this as a in our normal scalar field decaying as a sort of B things. Should I think of it? Or do you just want to say just the dark matter sector?
Only the dark matter is changing from it was moving at zero velocity, suddenly it's got a big velocity. But
and you don't produce radiation and other stuff.
According to this simple picture, right? It's all happening in the star sector.
So it becomes relativistic. Why is that like another neutrino that you can constrain at BDN?
Well, because remember, its contribution to the mass density was already very suppressed.
Wasn't interpreted.
What is the velocity that you get? Is it like relativistic?
Suppose that the S particle was a little bit heavier than the chi particle, so then it'd be quasi relativistic. Or it could have been much more, and then it would be really relativistic. So, we just assume that it was quasi relativistic here. And this is, so from the model building perspective, this is just to show you that making various assumptions for you're taking triplet dark matter with just two triplet Higgses to break the gauge symmetry, then you can characterize the vacuum manifold by the ratio of the beds, and you see what kind of mass splittings you get. So you see it's easy to get this inverted mass hierarchy. You could get the normal hierarchy as well. And the same is true if you complicate things by having more Higgses. There's plenty of cases with inverted hierarchy. You have a quintuplet Higgs, and you have this kind of mass spectrum. If you have quintuplet Higgses, then things get very intricate. But once again, you can find these inverted hierarchies. So, and as well, it's easy to build in the Z2 symmetry needed to keep the middle state stable. So it's not difficult to build models which do what you want. Oops. That's just saying it's not difficult. And the last thing I wanted to mention about this is we also looked at the not just the overall rate, but the angular distribution that you, yes.
So you make warm dark matter now? Is that because
it's only briefly warm because it's going to start
cooling down. Sure, you have free streaming, so you might have a structure on some scale. I'm not sure if this is...
Yeah, so if that's happening around the time of Big Bang nuclear synthesis, will we still see it? It's too early to affect power. Right?
Well, the question there is the phase space density that you create, basically, that you have some finite temperature, a large temperature for dark matter.
Yeah.
And then the question is, do your galaxies become deep enough?
So yeah, but don't you... I mean, if this was still happening after recombination, then I would care, I guess.
There's some warm dark matter constraints, the decaying particle into some light free streaming.
Yes, yes.
Degree of freedom. But those constraints only kick in at like 10 to the 6 seconds or so. Which is, it's well after BDN.
Okay.
I mean, well before recombination.
Okay, like that's
it. If it only lives like 1 second, the wedge is too much.
Okay, I see. So it's just 10 to the 6 second.
I think this is.
Yes, question. Very different question. So I thought you needed the big gap between chi1 and chi2 to explain why Dhamma sees a signal and other dark matter.
You just need the small gap for Dhamma. But we're giving up on Dhamma and everything I said.
No, but I mean... Well, the small gap is now a big gap. It's a whole...
So we have this... situation. So we're not trying to explain Dhamma.
No. But please excuse me. I see. So you're not thinking about a dark matter cross section of the size.
No, yeah, that was so. In order to do this game, we're assuming dumb is not real.
Okay. So in the original Neil and Doug model, they were trying to use this mass gap to explain dumb.
Yeah, they use this one to explain dumb and this one to explain integral.
Oh, I see.
And we're saying we can't make this one explain integral. That's
yes.
Right. This is just showing we predicted the angular distribution and compared the observed distribution. So this is in the sky, 20 degrees is the red line. And what we showed is that the dark matter profiles, which are most strongly peaked in the center, which are the ones we want, this is the Ionesco one that maximizes the rate, is also the one that's most consistent with the observed signal when you take into account that dark positrons can propagate before they annihilate. And it's been estimated they can propagate up to a kiloparsec, which corresponds to about this width in the sky. So all these ones that are wider than what's seen, those would be inconsistent. But if it's narrower, then you wouldn't rule it out. So we're showing the consistency.
I don't think this we can take very. It's not constant because we have essentially no idea about how positrons propagate and that they have lack extent.
I think, yeah, there's a lot of uncertainty, but in looking at the literature, the biggest estimate I could find for how far they could go was kiloparsec. If you think they could go farther, then you can ignore this. Let's see, do I have 5 minutes?
I like this idea.
Okay. Because this is just going to be a few more slides. So this last thing in progress is now coming back to Fermi and Pamela. There have been suggestions in the literature that substructure, that the halo, could be playing an important role. We know that the galaxy contains tens of thousands of subhalos, and these subhalos have their own subhalos. It's a fractal structure. This is something that's seen in simulations, in Aquarius and Via Lactea simulations. And an interesting thing about these subhalos, well, they're smaller, and also their velocity dispersions are smaller. And so that means the Sommerfeld effect can be bigger. And so even though their total mass is smaller, the cross-section could be compensated by that small velocity. And as I mentioned, the gamma ray constraints can be weakened if you're getting more signal from outside the center of the main halo. So there have been a number of papers that have looked at the contributions to gamma rays from annihilations in the subhalo. But so far, it seems to have asked the question of whether they could be a significant source of the leptons. And so this is what we've set out to do in this work. And we're using this Via Lactea data, which is available publicly. So now we have to compute this annihilation rate within each one of the subhalos. So we have to first compute the effective boost factor, the effective cross-section, which depends on the boost factor within each subhalo. And then we have to sum over tens of thousands of subhalos. And most of these subhalos are. So, and then we have to put it into propagation code. We're using YALPROP to figure out what we're going to see at Earth. And most of these subhalos are way outside of the diffusion zone, which YALPROP uses, which is just this disk. So we have to first freely propagate anything that comes from outside of there to the edge of this disk, and then compute what's the new source, the boundary. It's going to go into YALPROP. This is what my student Aaron has done. And so he's been searching the parameter space, he and Xu, to see.
The assumption is there's no matter outside the YALPROP.
Yeah, that that anything that would impede the electron propagation is negligible outside that region. So that's a simplifying assumption, but I think it's not a bad one. Mm-hmm. And so they've been searching the parameter space to see if you could find any fits to the data where the subhalos were dominant. And we did have one, but then it turned out when you compute the boron carbon ratio in that model, because he's varying parameters of Gell-Prop, it turned out to be terrible. So we've driven back to the drawing board to, so far this is the best fit. And the best thing we found so far is where 30% of the leptons are coming from, the subhalos. And here this is showing the subhalo contribution versus the main halo contribution to Fermi signal. And these are the effective boost factors you get for the main halo and the subhalo.
Are you varying the source on the edge of what's coming in the Gell-Prop and the Gell-Prop propagation parameters too?
Yes.
The Gell-Prop propagation. Oh, because then you don't know that the original fixing of Gell-Prop of the boron carbon of those parameters works, and then you have to go back and do a consistency check.
Yeah.
Okay,
that's right. So you see, you get now because you're getting a significant contribution from outside of, from larger distances, there's attenuation of the signal, and that means that you can get a good fit using a higher mass. And before we, before when we were getting the main contribution from the distance subhalos, we needed 14 TeV dark matter to get a good fit to that curve, because there's so much attenuation coming from the large distance subhalos. So here it's only 2 TeV dark matter. Unfortunately, the fit to Pamela is not good. You can see it's way down here with the chi-square of 100. So far, this is not looking that promising, but Aaron's still busy playing with parameters, seeing if he can find a better fit. So that's everything I wanted to tell you, and I'll just reiterate that even though pulsars may be the right explanation, it may also be impossible to know if they are the right explanation because of all the astrophysical uncertainties. And these constraints like the CMB constraints through Planck are really eating into the allowed parameter space, so maybe it will be possible. In addition, we expect data from Fermi, including the gamma ray constraints in the coming year or so. These things may allow us to rule out the dark matter explanation. And even if they do, it might be that there's parameter space where it could still explain the integral observations, even if it's not the right explanation for Fermi and Pamela. So I'm going to continue to explore that, and also this non-thermal dark matter history, I just think that's quite interesting, and I would like to look at the details of that more in the near future. So thank you very much for your attention.
Questions? So what was the non-thermal dark matter story again? The idea was to have you already had your dark matter form, it was just this, like a scalar test.
Yeah.
And then this has a branching ratio for one to decay to another dark matter.
Right.
And that's the...
Yeah, so it's just to give an era where the new daughter dark matter was moving too fast to be Sommerfeld enhanced for some period in cosmological history.
But the radic density then is really just set like if it was a thermal, because really you're presenting the radic density for that who was thermally produced originally. And it's not like, because when I think of non-thermal dark matter, I'm thinking of something that's not produced in thermal equilibrium.
Yeah, of course, I didn't tell you how the S was produced, but that could have been produced thermally. So it's not non-thermal in that sense.
And is it realistic to have a better doesn't indicate that you just have coupling to that particle?
Well, you know, I just wrote down this totally arbitrary coupling, so... okay, so you're saying if the branching ratio is not 1, should I be worried? So, then, you know, maybe I just had to tweak the original abundance of S to get the final abundance of chi right. So those are the kind of questions we need to look into.
You said that the pulsars were a story that could fit Fermi. Is there a similar kind of astrophysical story for the 511 KV excess?
Well, so there have been claims in the literature that, let's see, what are the claims? Low mass X-ray binaries was one hypothesis which Silk and company and strongly criticized, saying that those known low mass X-ray binaries are not really well correlated with distribution of the signal. And another one people have proposed is just radioactive element decay from supernovae. So there are papers that say we don't need anything else, that's enough. And but it's, you know, some small group who's saying that, and I don't see corroboration from, there doesn't seem to be any consensus in the astrophysics community.
Astrophysicists don't believe in consensus. They're very diverse.
Are there any final questions?
Thank you.